dignity in that. He knew it existed somewhere, but he could not expect a man like this prisoner, who'd spent his life elbow deep in human guts, to understand that. After a long silence, the prisoner closed his eyes and began to twitch like a worm cut in half, one side of him shrinking from the other as if in awful pain. John watched. The show revealed as much as the prophecy. The prisoner was a good performer, at least. But presently, he collapsed in a heap on the desk chair and said, "I can't. I can't, sir. I can't see anything right now." "Ah, well. Would that we could call down precognition when it suited us." "Mizar," he began, "take this fellow back to the jail."
"But what if I were to tell you something I already saw? It's real. I have it written in my notes that they confiscated. I can prove to you I wrote it a long time ago."
John leaned back on his elbows and into the fluffy boat of the mattress and didn't speak. The prisoner's eyes widened, and a peculiar blush went over his face. He looked to his shackled feet.
"I don't know if I should say it."
"Then don't say it, man. I haven't got time for dithering. I've wasted hours already in a damnable swoon." The prisoner nodded.
"What I saw, or part of what I saw, when I was in the trance months ago, was a feminine wildfire ripping through this very spot, in tandem with the comet, or rather, in relation to the comet. And I know that if you were to check with the, ladies of this court, you would find that they are all to a woman, bleeding at present."
John raised an eyebrow, his habit since childhood, which he had learned from imitating Mizar. He detested this gesture now, but could not stop doing it.
"Oh, yes."
The prisoner winced.
"It's true. Check. I have full confidence."
John frowned, but then shook his head.
"You believe these angels, you called them angels, correct, revealed that to you, that the ladies are bleeding? And you're certain you're not insane? Who cares about the menses of the palace women?"
The prisoner said,
"I am only a mouthpiece, which is why you must see this as proof of my visionary skill. Even when I didn't know what I was seeing something. Now it all makes sense. The angels told me."
"That we shall certainly see," John said with a dry snort. But the prisoner's claim was so extraordinarily bewildering that he found he could not rightly select a look appropriate to the situation. He felt his face begin to twist downward into an even deeper frown, but just as quickly he tightened back up the edges of his mouth.
Could it be true?
It was easy enough to verify, and after all, what had his own prayers and magic revealed? Ever?
This,
perhaps. Perhaps this man, small and roguish though he may be, was the very thing John had felt approaching without being able to name. And the king, how thrilled he would be if John could finally make an accurate prediction of the return. That was the entire reason for the favoritism King Michael showed John, for his continued monetary generosity. Why John alone of all the 9 orbital doctors had his own castle and the blessing of exemption from the royal court. The king wanted that date. John peered at the small man in the peacock blue, who appeared now to be on the verge of tears.
The man began to talk again. John stood abruptly.
"Enough, my God. Mizar, find out if what this man tells us is in any way true. And please discover these notes to which he keeps alluding, if they in fact exist. And you,"
he paused, turning back to the prisoner.
"What's your name?"
The man stared.
"We don't just tell our names. Not out on the land."
"Then make one up. I don't give a damn. You're not on the land. You're here, about to be de-headed, apparently. What does it matter if you tell your name?"
He watched as the prisoner's face fell.
Now, you won't die yet, good man. At least not if what you tell me is true. We may be able to help each other."
He snapped around to order Mizar to unchain the man, and was surprised to remember that he'd already ordered him away. John sulkily stepped to the exit, motioning to the prisoner.
Yes, come on then. You will hobble along after me. We will see how you fare at my mirrors, yes?
Maybe your angel voices will return. There's no time like the present.
At the door, the guard leaned over gingerly and whispered to him through his lion-shaped mask. John could hardly understand him through the thick resin, so he gestured for the man to pull it aside.
Go on. What? We've just had word that a new carnival has set up outside the palace walls, said the guard.
He had a black mustache with particles of food clinging to the corners.
They are flying a black flag. They appear to be, he frowned. Outlaws. They're here in the wrong season. And more than that, there are many more than a normal carnival. It may be dangerous to send a messenger on the road to the palace compound.
John felt not alarmed, but strangely disappointed by this news, and fought the desire to return to bed. A moment before, he'd had a strategy. Now he felt the old, shapeless anxiety gnawing at him once again, for this new trouble surely portended something as bad or worse than the comet or the vision-having prisoner.
Yes, he mumbled as the guard replaced his faceplate. I see. Well, at least take this man to a room and have Mizar dress him in something other than these filthy clothes. We will check on the ladies when the threat has passed.
John watched as the prisoner was led away down the narrow steps, then returned to his window. And it was there, in the distance, under the curious blaze of the new comet, settled in the scrubby awfulness of the coastal expanse, was a dense thicket of tents and booths and stages. This new encampment extended all the way to the sea, a great yawn of humanity, all bustling like ants under a huge iridescent black flag. John gripped the ledge with fingers he could not quite feel. The earthworks and the line of flimsy watchtowers that served the cape were dilapidated and had further deteriorated after a minor hurricane. But that had been years ago now. King Michael was not a man who valued his military. John peered over the plain, his heart in his throat, before he turned his eyes back to the sky and had the absurd thought that it would be far better to be struck dead by a heavenly body than by a living one. Chapter 7 The Third Queen of Cape Canaveral. That evening, the girl was released from her cage. Three old women attendants came to Mr. Capalaccio's tent. They said he had sent them. The girl stood on a padded footstool as they fussed with her gown. She watched as though from afar, like her body in this new dress was an experiment that could go horribly wrong. The oldest woman remarked,
How can an aged person like me keep straight all the queens at Cape Canaveral now? Now we have three queens, she bleated laughter, her eyes catching the girls mischievously.
A woman who had seen so many things she no longer took anything seriously. Her laugh trailed off into a gasping chuckle that caught in the back of her throat. Without thinking, the girl drew back, afraid as ever of any kind of sickness. The crone shook her head slightly after wiping her mouth, as if to say, It's nothing, and went back to pinning the dress with sharpened sticks. The crones were dressed in elaborate drapings of otter pelts, sewn in random places to dresses of thick brown fabric, with their gray hair wrapped around forms to keep it high and stiff. The girl wished Mr. Capalaccio had given her younger attendants, girls her own age, who would make her laugh and tell her gossip, like the illegal dancers in his carnival. Where had they gone? Were they here? Why hadn't he given her those girls? She looked across the tent at Orchid, who sat reading at Mr. Capalaccio's writing desk, ignoring the preparations. The crones kept creeping toward her in an attempt to dress her, too, but each time she waved them away brusquely. She was scouring stacks of papers and books, copying words occasionally into a slim book of her own. Every now and again, she stretched her hands over her head, exasperated, pulling her fingers through her hair and shaking it back down over the front of her pinched face. The crones wrestled with the girl's dress for a long time. It was sewn from material that looked very much like Mr. Capellaccio's flag. In fact, the girl thought it must be exactly the same. It took her some time to realize they weren't simply pinning it so they could work on it later. They were sewing her into it. They stitched two panels tightly up the center of her back, pulling mercilessly until she could hardly breathe. To distract herself, finally she gasped, "What are you looking for, Orchid?" Orchid spun around on her chair and glared. "They were brought in for you. I am not your nursemaid."
"I thought you were supposed to teach me things."
A sneer crept across her lips.
"You want to learn from me how to be his wife?
I'm sure you're quite good at it already. I can only imagine what has gone on in my absence." She turned back to the desk, muttering, "Oh yes, I'm imagining it, have no doubt. If I were not so indebted to the cause, I would not stand for the chicanery."
"Who are the other two queens? She said there were three now."
Orchid sighed elaborately. "What does he see in you? Your talk, your face, your body. You might as well be a yapping dog. I haven't got time for this."
Orchid's every reply made the girl more determined to engage her, although not for any reason beyond bothering her. "What are you doing?" she asked.
Orchid rose unexpectedly. Her slender body was very beautiful. The girl could not help but notice. The strong thighs, her hips, which flared like a carved instrument.
"Well, since you insist on being infantile, let us teach you then.
Let us count the queens. First, there's me. I've been his queen-to-be since we were 16. That was after my mother, our prophetess Lois, had passed from this realm. But I guess he hasn't told you that story either, has he?"
Orchid looked away, her face betraying nothing.
A crone poked the girl and entreated her to remain very still while she finished stitching the back of the dress.
"Then there's the queen inside the palace," said Orchid. "She's the second queen, King Michael's wife, Allison. She is the daughter of Marvel Parsons, the Hierophant. Terribly spoiled, so they say. I wouldn't know personally. We've never met." She said this as though the girl should know there was no chance they ever would have met.
"Allison is the one you will usurp once our uprising begins. You'll probably have to dehead her yourself."
"That's what I'd do. It would make a decent show of authority."
She came nearer to the girl on her footstool with widened eyes. "But then..." She trailed off and leaned forward, speaking more quietly. "There is another. She's not a queen exactly. The Pardoness." The word hung in the air, changing the room. The crones stopped sewing. They seemed to hold their breath.
"Who is the Pardoness?" the girl asked finally.
"Who is that? She asks, who is that?"
the old women bubbled with nervous laughter.
At this, the girl felt a frenetic darkening begin inside her, little shadows flitting past at a preposterous speed, but she kept her voice light. "How should I know who she is? I've never been here before," she said carefully. "My mother is a walking doctor who abandoned me. She told me only mad people live at the Cape. I don't know anything about anyone here."
Orchid nodded.
"Poor girl. Abandoned by everyone who's had charge of you. It can't be your fault they all left you, can it?"
The girl flinched. "We are all just people, though we may be queens. Me, Allison, you. The Pardoness is different. She is descended from a man who once visited space. Do you understand that? What that means? She is a living relic. She lives in the palace compound, as has every one of her forebears since before there even was a palace, kept mercifully apart from the world's hideousness. Michael houses her high above us all in a tower," Orchid nodded, "from which she dispenses cosmic justice." Orchid went to the door of the tent and drew back the flaps, She pointed across Mr. Capellatio's vast carnival to the tallest and brightest minaret in the palace compound. In Canaveral Tower. She has lived there since she was a child. We do not dispute her authority as a beacon of justice. David does not intend to dethrone her. She turned back and spoke flatly. What were we talking about? Oh, the queens. And then there's you, apparently. The third queen. You will be the third queen after tonight. Why do you accept the Pardoness's judgments if you don't like anything else about the cape? Orchid let the tent flap close. I don't know why. Why is a question most are not fit to ask? She flung her eyes to the crones, like a person tossing a stick for a dog, hoping they might give chase. They all laughed. Orchid said, Not even me. I don't even know why you are to be David's queen.
You mean instead of you?
Orchid met her eyes. Yes.
Can't we both be queens?
Oh, would you shut up? I'm trying to read, Your Majesty. Perhaps you should be reading about the religion you are so blindly entering as a leader, she muttered, casting her eyes at the girl's pile of books. At once her face changed, and the girl knew she'd seen the book Argento had given her, The True King. Orchid leapt to her feet and went into the cage, which stood open now, and snatched out the hard-bound volume and held it up with one hand. This, she cried, you've had it the whole time. That's mine. Why did you have this? This is my finest piece of scholarship. It's everything I have ever learned about our history collected and retold for the ages.
That's mine, the girl said again. This time coldly.
She folded her arms over her chest. Orchid hefted the book up and flipped to a certain page, as though she'd known all along where she would find what she'd been looking for. The pinch between her eyes deepened. Here. It reads just as I remembered. Of course it does. She is thunder, the perfect mind who rings in a brilliant age. A young sigil dressed all in white shall appear when at last the rockets have returned to Earth, and this sigil shall sit enthroned during all the days of heaven. This is the passage David is using to justify your existence. But he is wrong. Wrong, wrong, wrong.
As the minutes passed, and Orchid read and took furious notes, as the girl stood quietly while the crones sewed her dress, she couldn't help but feel sad for Orchid. This empathy was her downfall. She was beginning to recognize it, for it had happened with Mr. Capellatio as well. She had begun to love him. Overnight, Orchid's whole world had changed. The girl could imagine it all too well. But Orchid also frightened her, the particular violence of being a violent woman in the violent world. What was it like to cut off heads? She looked at Orchid and shuddered. Then the girl felt sorry for herself more than anyone. Orchid appeared to be the only companion she would have in Mr. Capellatio's world. Orchid turned back to her suddenly, and after a visible struggle, attempted to smile. She came over to the girl and put a gentle hand on her hair. I suppose I cannot be angry at you for not knowing our religion, for never having read anything I've written. That would be very poor character on my part. David has already explained the difference between you and me. You are mentioned in scripture, but I am not. To put it simply, David believes you are more important than I am. So you are supposed to be his queen. But, she nodded, and I will be a minor queen, a glorified concubine. But since in this case David is wrong, it occurs to me that something I have recorded for him is likewise wrong. Over the years I have misled him, though I did not mean to. I shoulder the entire responsibility for this error. She blinked her water-clear eyes. My task now is to edit the offending text. If you will excuse me. She turned back to the desk, but the crone with the tallest hair, who seemed in charge, gingerly steered Orchid to another stool and began dressing her as well, in a slightly less beautiful dress, but one that was lovely all the same. Orchid scrunched her nose as they flocked around her. I suppose it doesn't matter if I formulate my reinterpretation of the passage now, or after this wedding, or whatever he wants to call this rude display of bigamy that we are about to embark upon. He has always listened to reason, and this time will be no different. The girl lifted her arm so a crone could stitch under it. She understood why Orchid hated her. How sad it must be to give up everything, your power, your influence, your husband, and then be forced to serve the person to whom you gave it. Orchid's dress slipped off her shoulders while they began pinning. She looked beautiful, the girl thought without wanting to, so unsettlingly angry and lovely. I will tolerate you, Orchid said, again nearly reading the girl's mind. For now. The girl scowled. Mr. Capellatio had made his choice. Orchid was the loser. In spite of her pity, the girl felt grateful to be the one in the more beautiful dress, even if she was not more beautiful and accomplished herself. Orchid gazed back at her for a while, as though she understood those thoughts too, until finally she looked away. Chapter 8 The Rider. John, the chief orbital doctor, reconsidered his options and sought Mizar to dispatch a rider to the palace compound. The carnival was far enough away, and the rider would be fast enough, he reasoned, that they would have their answer about the women's bleeding in several short hours. John pondered if the odd little prisoner proved correct in his prediction. What did it mean? Mizar, always sensitive to the plights of servants, insisted that the rider would be dangerously exposed on the plain. We do not even know yet if the outlaw carnival is a threat, John growled. Mizar stared at him as though his master were 8 years old once again, all flapping arms and ill-advised schemes.
Of course they are a threat, sir. What reason could they have to break the law and return here out of season? The question is, would they attack a rider on the way from an insignificant country house?
At that, John bristled.
I would hardly call Urania insignificant. I have more scrying instruments here than probably anyone in the world, and I would assume, given the circumstances,
and here he gestured to the light above, that they would find my manor house most interesting.
But why am I arguing against my own position? He demanded,
to which his servant merely smiled. Mizar had a manipulative streak. At last, John sent him to prepare a hot drink and went to his office to wait. John begrudged Mizar his little insult. It dampened his excitement. He was sensitive about Urania Castle, even though he was the only orbital doctor to have his own separate quarters. Even the Hierophant himself, the king's high priest and advisor, lived inside the compound. But then let us be honest, John thought, gripping the windowsill in his office and looking into the courtyard. Urania was hardly a castle at all, though he had taken pains to make it appear as such. It was all vanity. He was the last scion of a family to whom appearances had mattered, and so they mattered to John, even though ostentation was not a feature inherent to his character. Primarily, Urania was a place to keep his instruments. He maintained them meticulously, tucked beneath weather-tight mechanical domes of his own design. This was indeed a battle, a philosophical one for him and a physical one for Mizar, for the domes were not ever completely fast, despite their combined efforts, and at last John had been forced to admit he was no engineer. Now he cursed the rust grinding in the dome gears each time he cranked one open. He cursed the broad speckling of salt ruin on the deteriorating instruments. They'd become the easiest place upon which to fixate his self-loathing. His disappointment in himself, which like a desolate satellite circled the mass of his being, pulled up tides of shame regularly. When he looked at his courtyard of once splendid instruments, which he still loved for their mathematics and precision, He cursed himself for being as unlike them as seemed possible. So fickle he was, incapable of discerning truth. The news about the women's bleeding arrived in a flurry of hoofbeats at the gravel at Urania's gate, more quickly than John had anticipated. It was borne not by his own rider, but by a tall and thin young man wearing an ill-fitting guard's uniform. Spotting him through the streaked glass of his office window, John fairly fell over himself to get outside. All thoughts of past failures washed away now by the hope that the prisoner had indeed made a real prediction. As John threw a coat over his bedclothes, he shouted to Mizar to fetch the prisoner from his room. The young guard's mount was an exceptionally fine, roan-colored horse. The guard was reaching forward to swing the gate open himself when John called,
"Ho! Not so fast! It's locked!"
But the gate opened anyway, leaving John to sputter impotent protest to no one in particular. The guard stood in the open gateway, holding his horse's reins, a smile on his lips. "Lord Astronomer?" He made a small bow. John cleared his throat.
"Who are you? Where is my rider?"
He narrowed his eyes. "Is that one of the Hierophant's horses?"
"I was sent by His Majesty Marvel Parsons to collect the prisoner you're interviewing."
The man's accent was thick and hard to place.
"I hardly think so," John huffed. "Where is my man? I sent him with a specific question, and I require a specific answer. I cannot release the prisoner to you until I have it. It's impossible."
"Well, the Hierophant outranks you," he replied blithely.
"Sir?" "That's preposterous."
Like most courtiers of his status, John had discovered that the best way to communicate with the lower classes was with a certain blustering indignation. It relieved them all of the apprehension that friendliness might be possible.
"What is your name?"
"Juniper."
"That's a woman's name."
Another sanguine smile.
"I've never heard that before.
Where is the prisoner, Tygo?"
"He's here,"
came Mizar's chirp from behind John. He scuffed toward them across the scrubby courtyard, around the reflecting pond with John's expensive fish, leading the prisoner by a short chain. The prisoner, Tygo, by now had been shorn of his leg cuffs, given new clothes, and chained again at the hands with a set of much more functional manacles. The clothes seemed to greatly displease him. They were Mizar's, and therefore ugly, being brown and far too long and also too tight in the upper arms and legs. Mizar handed John the prisoner's short chain and hurried over to open the gate wider. Tycho nodded his head upward at the young guard. The other man did the same.
"If the Hierophant outranks me, it's only because of tradition. Michael has privileged my work for 20 years and more," John sniffed. "You would be too young to know that."
John did not add that, in his view, Marvel Parsons was the upstart poisoner with the delicate hand who, 32 years before, during the reign of Michael's father, Leander, had murdered John's own parents along with their entire retinue of dinner guests. They had numbered 14 that dreadful evening, all dead before dessert. John had been good that day, and so was permitted to eat with Mizar in the kitchen, with the servants, which had been a treat until it wasn't, when he realized how undignified it was. There was never proof of the Hierophant's hand in the affair, of course. Only the most cursory of inquiries had followed the deaths. No one was ever formally accused, but ever since John had been of an age to reason, he had suspected Marvel Whiteside Parsons. There was an air of menace around that man, a kind of radical but rational willingness to play the game to its logical end. In fact, John somewhat admired the daring do such drastic action had required. He'd never been over fond of his family anyway.
"You can't take him now," he repeated.
"But I must."
"Does the Hierophant not look up?"
John was flabbergasted. He pointed to the sky.
"What traitor's interrogation could be worth more than discovering what that is? I have removed Tygo for the very immediate reason that he claims to be a visionary who predicted this light. You go straight back and tell your master that I simply refuse. He can come here himself if he disagrees."
Despite scrying with his magic bowls and all the evening spent in rapt meditation, willing his body to open like a night flower to the celestial plan, despite locating himself at the navel of the world that connected the earth magically to the heavens, despite how endlessly he gave of himself, there had always been something broken about John's faith, some enormous failure of will, something faltering about his belief. He did not know if that was the cause of his failure, but he suspected it. How could he release a man who might be the genuine article? Juniper's horse stomped the ground. Tygo looked at him pleadingly. John felt a dizzy alarm, as though the two of them, Tygo and himself, were about to embark on a journey for which they were not prepared. Tygo straightened his coat. They looked up into the vast sky overhead and the diffuse late afternoon sunlight throbbing beneath the gauze of clouds, and yet the comet beyond was brighter yet, and more mysterious still, and choked John with a presentiment of danger beyond the physical. He could not explain it. Tygo's face, apart from the star tattoos, was very pale.
I'll go back with him, if that's what I have to do.
It's not your decision.
John closed his eyes and opened them again.
It's not yours either, said Juniper.
Tygo said in a pleading voice,
You don't understand.
No, you don't.
Juniper shook his head. John looked between the two of them, bewildered.
Let's take my carriage then, he said slowly. I will talk to Marvel myself.
My God, this is a gigantic waste of time, when we may have precious little—
Mizar clicked his tongue.
The outlaws on the plane, sir.
He whirled around.
This miscreant got here all right, didn't he? I assume we will be fine.
Tygo laughed unhappily.
You should never assume anything.
John was already stalking back to the house to put on decent clothes.
I assume things only when blundering idiots— Force me to.
From John's vantage point in his open cart, in the darkening gray and green afternoon, he observed a crowd of carnival people gathering down by the shoreline. Peeking from between the dunes as the mule-drawn carriage bumped along was an impressive collection of booths and tents. There was a raft of some kind down there, some structure being erected a ways out in the water, past the breaking surf. The people milled about like they were waiting for something. The outlaw carnival winked in and out of sight. Still, John could hardly believe his eyes. There were so many people by the shore, more than there were palace guards and infantry at the palace, that was certain. The landscape before their own carriage lay bare, exposed and open all the way to the Cape compound, and he suddenly felt they were very stupid to have set out upon this new land. The guard riding his horse beside them gave him little comfort. If anything, his uniform might attract attention. Mizar, unflappable, did not slow or hasten the carriage, but muttered gently from the driver's bench.
They're building something down there, aren't they? If it's for a good purpose, I'll be most surprised.
John's mouth was dry. His heart lurched, but he kept his face expressionless.
Surely the palace guards are watching these outlaws.
Beside him in the back seat, Tygo was kicking the wooden floorboards rhythmically with his heels. John saw in his face a firm determination to distract himself from their immediate task. It seemed he was tapping out some familiar tune, but John could not place it. The noise set his teeth on edge. These ill omens will come to naught, he assured himself.
They must. All of them.
The comet, the prophetic prisoner, the outlaw carnival. All at once, he couldn't imagine the idea that he and this ignominious man might be the only people in the world who could interpret the meaning of these strange occurrences. It seemed dreadful. And yet, this was how the world worked, wasn't it? The world gave you nothing, until that nothing added up over the years in some obscure way to produce something.
Speed up, you fool! He grumbled to Mizar, just so someone would be talking. Do you think these criminals would not grab us for a ransom?
I have no idea, sir, said Mizar, and smiled.
His knotty hands flicked the reins, and the two mules drawing the wagon roused themselves minimally, protesting with alternating percussive snorts.
"You know," said John to Tygo after a time, "I confess I thought you were lying before, about predicting the comet."
He considered, "I'm sure I don't need to tell you that you have a very dishonest face."
"Others have let me know.
But do tell me truly, do you think we will be snatched from the road here? Can you predict that?" John laughed uneasily.
"Because I have a worry we will."
Tygo kept his eyes facing forward.
"Prediction doesn't work like that."
"How then does it work?"
"I'm curious."
He sighed.
"I don't know. I told you I'm a surgeon. Ask me to pull out your bowel and have it function in a sack beside you for weeks on end, and I can do that. I'd like to do it. It gives me joy to do it. But I don't know how to predict anything. It just happens. I went to sleep. I had a dream. I woke up in a trance, and my shaving mirror showed me the comet. It showed me..."
He paused, embarrassed.
"Well, the angels showed me."
John rolled his eyes. Tygo said,
"The proof is here before your face. The ladies are bleeding. You'll see. It will be just like I told you."
"You could have magicked those ladies at any point, and this prediction will be nothing more than a trick you devised to get yourself released. I wasn't born yesterday." Tygo balled his fists and unballed them.
"I told you, I don't believe in your stupid star magic. I believe in science, sir, and that's the end of it. No spells, no magic, no bloodletting, no executions, no rocket ships. None of that is for me. I don't think it works. Science is the first and the last, and whatever else there is in the world has got no business influencing anything important, least of all human lives. So call me a liar, by all means. I'm used to it. Or call me a con man. But never say I've done magic. Nothing insults me more. I've spent my whole life hiding from the law and groveling for my head when I'm caught. I'd slit my throat before I did magic. And maybe I will anyway in the end. Just to get away from you people."
He spread his hands to encompass the cape and all its environs, and he shook his head.
"You're all morons."
A door in John's chest seemed to crack, and a peculiar light came in. He chuckled again. There was a darting quality to this man, a venomous puppy snap that was appealing for all its sharpness. John supposed the prisoner was very clever indeed, and yet disgusted by his own cleverness, an attribute John himself rather enjoyed, since he felt his own nature to be similar. "My friend, it's your mouth that's gotten you condemned, not your fool beliefs. But you do at least acknowledge there were once shuttles, correct? For God's sakes, we have abundant proof. It's not as though we've based our laws on nothing. You can see the launch sites yourself, man. We have people who can trace their ancestors to that time."
"Thousand-year-old structures you've rebuilt to suit your tastes don't mean a damn thing to me. Your asinine executions and dumping of poisoned blood have destroyed the better part of this land. And this land is vast, Mr. Astronomer. I can't begin to tell you the damage your priests have done. We'll all die of benthead thanks to them."
The cart trundled over a bump, and Tygo slid ungracefully into the side of the carriage, but righted himself, and continued with a rueful smile.
"It's a farce played out with an immensity that staggers the mind. If I hadn't given my life to opposing your idiotic laws, I would have killed myself decades ago."
John nodded. "Is it true that you can heal people?" Tygo's smile faltered.
"My mother is a famous walking doctor. Or was. Maybe she's dead now."
"I wouldn't know." John raised his eyebrows.
"She taught you your surgery?"
Tygo did not answer for a long time. Outside their carriage, the slender black scrim lip of the marsh lapped at grass mere feet from the cart path, and the mule's hooves sucked up the grasses, and further beyond them a bedraggled pine tree stuck above lowland bushes. John peered at Tygo, who blinked slowly, and tugged the hair down over his ear holes. It was a habit, John noticed.
"I came here to find my fortune,
Tygo said with a straight face. I'm a con man. I thought I already told you. He grinned finally. And my mother hates me. She never taught me anything. John nodded. I have always enjoyed liars. I'm not sure why. They're much more fun. So you're not a surgeon? I go around as one. It makes good money. Finally, they picked me up for it. Now I'm kicking myself, eh? John realized he was spellbound before this man, lost, almost in the way of a child whose father has journeyed to many unimaginable places. Why do I disbelieve you? Tygo smiled wider. Maybe you have trouble trusting people. He looked away. I just like to travel. That's all. This was all a big mistake. Now I could lose my head. John discovered that he was smiling too. Except your prophecy. That is real. Well, yes. They rode the rest of the way to the palace in startled silence, the bloat of friendliness suddenly distending the air between them like a rude noise. This strange comfort struck the astronomer as ill-advised, for what good could friendship do him now, when it had never done him any good before? And as he thought this, his eyes were searching the countryside at the same moment, looking for outlaw riders or carnival men or legions of lawbreakers. But no one came, and no one followed them. Chapter 9 Marvel and the Astronomer. Following his interview with the Pardoness, Marvel Whiteside Parsons marched to his own chamber at the top of Endeavor Tower, where his window shades remained drawn, even though a wintry dusk was rapidly descending. He must have a moment to think. The cool gloom entered him like a trickle of water down his throat. He breathed a few times. As soon as he'd stepped from beneath the shadow of Canaveral Tower, a servant brought him a note bearing the startling news that an outlaw carnival had set up on the plain, just between the palace compound and the shore. King Michael was unconcerned, the note promised. Marvel knew that meant nothing. Michael was always unconcerned, by worldly matters at any rate. He was the sort of king who would fine the carnival, rather than make an example of them for returning to the Cape out of season. Marvel, for his part, could not help but suspect their arrival had everything to do with the light in the sky. Why else would a carnival come back during the winter season? It was one of the oldest parts of their law that the land should rest after summer carnivals, so the blood would have time to work its magic in the earth. It had been written by Hulda herself. Was Juniper a spy for this outlaw carnival? Had he lied about coming from Kansas? And William Tygo, the earless prisoner from Kansas, why was he really here? No one just came from Kansas to be a walking doctor at the Cape. The deathscapes, even with a walking doctor's maps, one wouldn't risk such a journey without a reason. At his desk, an enormous solid wood heirloom from the king's family, Marvel rifled unread papers absently. There was much to be done. Purpose had been his comfort always. Even now, his instinct was to do something more, to create some motion that would satisfy him. But instead, he attempted to wait. And think. The smart choice would be to leave immediately. It was what he would tell himself to do, if he were his own advisor. There were too many coincidences, too many novel happenings. It must mean something. Leave, he said to himself. Just pack your bag and leave now. He thought he could use Juniper as a guide in the deathscapes, but there was no time now to ascertain the exact nature of his treachery. Unless Marvel had him tortured. Then, if Juniper truly had come from Kansas, Marvel would bring him along as a guide. He sat down. He took a breath. But that would be too dangerous. How could he be sure Juniper wouldn't murder him in the night? Marvel was 51, large and healthy, but no one could survive a head bashed to a bloody pulp by a tree limb or a throat slitting. It was best he go alone. Now. But the poisonous land.
He didn't trust any walking doctor's maps, didn't trust himself to remember how he had crossed the death gates at 14. It had been luck, pure and simple, though back then he'd believed it was a divine blessing for killing the Mystagogue. He didn't trust a carnival man to take him, because they often made mistakes in their navigation. Whole carnivals died all the time. It was well known. And if Marvel did make it to Kansas, Seat of Dread, what then? Where the gruesome cows still lurched on their cloven hooves, eating the dead and the living indiscriminately, where dark monks did dark magic and prayed for the end of the world? Marvel could hardly imagine it. Only that morning, he'd assumed he'd soon make the journey alone, but finally doing so was not as easy as planning for it. He had known it would not be, and still he had not imagined he would feel such fear. Marvel stared blankly at the desk. It had been Michael's father, Leander's desk, and many other kings before him, and was a thing of great beauty. Marvel had believed for years that he should give it up. He was an ascetic now. It was not his, of course, which lessened his guilt. Hewn from mahogany centuries before, deeply varnished and nearly as wide as it was long, it bore many of his tinctures and oils, and accounts, diagrams for magical rites, Michael's infernal horoscopes. How the king loved having that silly astronomer John Sousa draw up horoscopes for him, a habit Marvel found particularly repellent. He picked up a bottle. The liquid could become poison if he wished, with only a few drops from another glass dropper. When, at the tender age of 19, he had achieved his first assassination for Leander, he had been very unskilled. He had accidentally killed an entire dinner party, and very nearly also murdered John Sousa, then just a boy. The intended victim had been Sousa's mother, pregnant by Leander, and becoming very shrill about it. John Sousa had hated Marvel ever since, of course, as was his right. He rang a bell for a servant, turned around in his chair, and opened his shades. There were the outlaws, camped down by the shore, not beside the compound wall where they usually set up camp when they brought their yearly tributes. In fact, the outlaws were very close to the first watchtower in the defense line, which was barely visible from Marvel's window. This was intentional, he supposed. The earthworks were long neglected. Why should the outlaws fear an unmanned defensive line? They had no intent to surprise, obviously. The servant knocked. Marvel's knees cracked when he stood. He pulled open the slot on his chamber door. A middle-aged man with yellow hair, whose name Marvel could never recall, looked at him nervously.
"You called, Majesty?"
"I need a man to ride out to that carnival on the plain and discover their business. They shouldn't be here." He spoke as though no one should be worried.
"That has already been ordered by the king. The riders will be back shortly, but I have more news for you."
"Proceed, then."
"A guard has returned with the chief orbital doctor, and a captive in chains. They wait for you in the receiving room."
"I didn't send for Sousa. I don't want to see him now."
"He would not be seen, sir."
"Tell him to go away."
The servant bowed. "I would very much like to, but he's in a bad temper, and he says he has something very important to tell you about the comet, he's calling it."
It would not do to insult John Sousa. He was unfortunately one of King Michael's favorites. The Sousas had been at Cape Canaveral 1,000 years. John had harbored an especial loathing for him since Marvel had registered distaste at the expense of Urania, John's gaudy manor castle.
Had the astronomer truly needed his own observatory, a castle in miniature, with all the contraptions and instruments his heart desired?
Marvel hadn't thought so. By that time, the extravagance of the Cape had worn him down, and he was rejecting plans for improvement everywhere. But Michael had been happy enough to override Marvel's judgment, with the caveat that the astronomer should feed and house any and all of the numerous foreign orbital doctors who might come to cast yet more horoscopes and make yet more detailed predictions of the return date. It was, after all, His Majesty's passion to know the exact day and time.
"I will see them," Marvel mumbled, and slid shut the viewing slot.
He wanted to pray. He had, in past times of confusion, prayed before any decision. But today, he felt empty of magic. His rooms were paneled in stained wood, because the rooms in Hulda's Black Tower in Kansas had been made of volcanic rock and were very dark and close. Since he was a boy, work meant a dim room. Daylight was time off, a game, a ride on a horse. But Marvel's eye was drawn now to a gray trapezoid of light that had fallen on the floor when he pulled up the shades, and he went to it and knelt. His hands on the bare floor looked suddenly old to him, and he closed his eyes. At the moment of his unkingly birth in the Black Watchtower, his mother, the nun, had been nearing 34 years of age and had been attempting to have a child for 7 years. Marvel had learned her age from a compendium of royal personages he found in the tower library. She had been born of a family who claimed never to have lost a single person to Benthead and had become a nun of her own volition when she was only 12 years old. Later, the Mystagogue had her thrown from the Black Tower. The volume stressed her piety, her beauty. She was called the most beautiful woman in Kansas. A striking drawing of her accompanied her biography in the compendium, which showed her to have wide-set eyes and a square face, straight dark hair plaited like a farm girl's, with a half-moon fringe that all the nuns at the Black Watchtower wore in those days. Beneath the drawing was written her name, Nassa Whiteside. He had since observed a very good likeness of that face upon the visage of his own daughter, Allison, King Michael's second wife. Allison was a woman very much like the record described Nassa, libidinous, gorgeous, querulous, athletic, above all else and in most situations, easily bored. Marvel was as proud of her beauty as he was ashamed of her shallowness. She drank palm wine to excess with her handmaids and had bred a line of small dogs since she was 9 years old, improving their appearance markedly in each generation. Other courtiers bought them from her now, so a parade of small black dogs with ribbons tied behind their ears was a feature at any court gathering. Allison had caught the king's eye, if such a thing can be said, for it was questionable that any woman or man anywhere had ever truly distracted Michael from his spiritual quest, after the unfortunate death of his first queen, Rachel Moonstorm. Rachel had been allowed to fall from a tower, since she had not conceived a child in 10 years of marriage, and she came from a noble family too powerful to risk angering with a divorce. It had been Marvel's idea. Michael, reluctant because he actually loved her, had seemed unhappier since then, but it was not a matter that could be rectified by anything but time. Marvel, gently, suggested that Allison might make a lovely bride for him. Michael never asked why Marvel himself had sired only one child. Perhaps he sensed Marvel's attentions ran in another direction. Children were a distraction to a religious man anyway. And yet, Marvel loved his daughter. He tried not to allow himself to think of what might happen to her if she, too, failed to conceive for Michael. She had only been queen a few years. There would always be Michael's inattention to blame it on. He was forever at his meditative walking, or having his horoscope made. Impractical and kind. The king's nature irked Marvel as much as it inspired him. He had controlled things for Michael for the better part of 25 years. If Marvel left, however, Allison would have to fend for herself. He would write her something that explained why. He did not know what to say yet, but when he did, he would write. He might even invite her to join him, though he knew she would not. Standing, Marvel dusted off his knees. So many hands holding back the pieces of his heart. So many people he would betray if he left. so many dangers he would face, alone or with Juniper as his guide. But truly, he had already made the choice. He felt an urgency now, a gift from the heavens to move him forward. He went to his desk to mix poisons. The receiving room was an Endeavor tower, several levels below Marvel's private quarters. The chamber required formality to achieve its purpose, which was to intimidate and impress. So Marvel had kept all the fine chairs, the woven carpets, the embroidered hangings recording the cape's history. Some of them were centuries old. The king's chair sat on a raised dais alongside another, smaller chair, and Marvel sat there unselfconsciously. Someone had to. Michael never used this room. Finding his company waiting for him, he strode straight past the chair and only faced them once he had arranged himself. There stood three men of vastly different ranks. Juniper, still dressed in his shabby guard's uniform and now covered in dust from riding. Tygo, earless, wearing new clothes that didn't fit. And John Sousa, who looked as he always did, like a man who was so far from knowing he was good-looking as to persuade everyone that he wasn't. It rankled Marvel, that obliviousness. John's dress was, as ever, impeccable and fussy, though Marvel suspected this was entirely due to his overcapable manservant. Sousa was more than convinced of his own brilliance, however, and as soon as Marvel had seated himself in the grand chair, John said, "Do you have any idea what a nuisance you've caused me? What danger you've put us into travel here? When there is an outlaw carnival camped just minutes away, damn you, I have tolerated you forever, seemingly forever. I won't any more, and that is all I have to say."
"You came a long way to say it, then," Marvel replied in a dry voice.
"Indeed, I damn well did come, because your man compelled me. The prisoner and I are at work on," he sputtered, began to pace, "on a thing that could be everything. Do you understand? The light in the sky? Have you seen it?"
Marvel looked on with an icy stiffness.
"I want to talk to Michael," Sousa said at last.
"I don't think so. He is at his meditations. Tell me what this is about. Because I have an urgent need of this prisoner at the moment, and will send you away."
Tygo paled, but mastered it so quickly that no one but Marvel noticed. Marvel leaned forward to get a better view of those ear holes. Tygo shook his hair over them on purpose. Juniper was gaping at the wall hangings, the floors, which were made of polished limestone and inlaid with mosaics of the shuttles, and the ornately carved chairs. A bench at one side of the room was covered in dark green silk that Marvel had always liked. Juniper looked at it. He might be from Kansas indeed, if this ornamentation appalled him. Or he could be from anywhere else in the world. Marvel's head had begun to hurt.
"I have need of Tygo as well," Sousa was protesting. "More so, I say, than you. He's told me that he predicted this comet. He has writings that prove it. I was skeptical. It seems a ploy to save himself. But as further proof, he's offered another prediction, one that I am at pains to discover the truth of. That is the most important matter at hand."
"I would say discovering the nature of the outlaw carnival is the most important matter at hand."
"And you would be mistaken, as you usually are."
Sousa flashed his teeth in what Marvel supposed was meant as a smile, but which came off nothing like one.
"These occurrences are connected, have no doubt. If this convict has predicted the comet's arrival, then there is a chance we can ascertain the return date. Do you understand? We will know once and for all. We could know."
Marvel's certainty that the return, if it happened at all, would happen in Kansas was firm, but he couldn't say it aloud.
"The day that you could tell me anything I don't already know has not yet dawned, astronomer. Michael may be in your thrall, but that's why I'm here, to make sense of the preposterous. You've calculated for 20 years, yet we've never had the date from you.
Why would you suddenly know it now? Susa pointed to the heavens and then flung his hands to his sides.
I'd say there's your reason. Things are a bit different now.
Marvel snapped.
What is the prediction you're trying to prove?
There are two, I said.
Weren't you listening? The prisoner claims he recorded this comet, this stellar nova, whatever it is,